From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Republican Senator Rand Paul appears to be positioning himself to run for president. Today we talk with Ryan Lizza, who profiles Paul in the current edition of The New Yorker.
Rand is trying to figure out how much libertarianism can the system put up with? How much support for his more hardcore views is there?
Before running for the Senate in 2010, Rand worked on several campaigns for his father, libertarian Ron Paul. But now, Lizza says, Rand is trying to rebrand himself as more moderate than his father and than his own previous positions.
This is really a piece about a father and son who share so much in common. And now, for him to get where he wants to go next, his father is basically what's standing in the way.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews Blake Mills' new album, Hi Ho. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The number of people potentially exposed to Ebola from a single patient in Texas is up sharply. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports from Dallas that they're being watched closely for any signs of the virus.
Texas health officials are now looking at up to 100 individuals. That number is up from 12 to 18 people who were directly exposed to a single traveler carrying Ebola from Liberia. The new contacts come because the 12 to 18 direct contacts interacted with others. Some of the new contacts will be asked to take their own temperatures daily for 21 days. They are being instructed to immediately report any signs or symptoms of Ebola to the authorities. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Dallas.
Information emerging about the Ebola patient under care at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. According to his sister, Thomas Duncan first reported to a Dallas emergency room when he was feeling ill and said he'd been in Liberia. He was sent home with antibiotics just 2 days before he sought hospital care again for worsening symptoms. Pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong are not relenting. Student leaders seeking the resignation of their territory's top official vow to ramp up their protests, including occupying several important government buildings. At this hour, Hong Kong's chief secretary is offering to meet with the demonstrators, but he is refusing to resign. The United Nations estimates that more than 9,000 civilians have been killed in Iraq this year. Susanna George reports this comes as Islamic State militants have expanded into Iraq, taking control of nearly a third of the country.
The numbers, some of the highest since Iraq's bloody civil war in 2007, show just how much the country's crisis has deteriorated. Francesco Motta is with the UN in Baghdad.
It's really dire, and it potentially is going to have ramifications for a generation or more if it's not dealt with quickly.
Motta says most of the civilian casualties this year have been the result of armed conflict and ISIS policies of directly targeting civilian groups, particularly minorities. For NPR News, I'm Susanna George in Erbil, northern Iraq.
President Obama spent last night at his family home in Chicago. He'll be speaking about the economy early this afternoon at nearby Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. It's the president's way of reconnecting with the domestic agenda after a long, intense focus on international challenges. Tomorrow, the president is slated to talk about jobs in Indiana. The Labor Department says the number of people seeking jobless benefits has dropped to the lowest point since June of 2006. Overall, 2.3 million people are receiving jobless aid. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 90, the NASDAQ down 39. This is NPR. The outlook for the auto industry is cloudy, according to Fiat Chrysler's CEO. Sergio Marchionne cited a profit warning from Ford that trouble in South America and Russia would leave Ford short of its anticipated earnings this year. Speaking before the Paris Motor Show, Marchionne said that he didn't anticipate a robust European economy for a while, although he believes the worst is over. In Nigeria, the presumed leader of the Islamist insurgent Boko Haram group has dismissed military claims of his death. NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton reports Boko Haram has released a new video warning.
Brandishing an assault rifle and firing shots into the air from an anti-aircraft gun, Abubakar Shekau wears combat fatigues and his trademark grimace as he taunts Nigeria's army. Flanked by heavily armed masked fighters, Boko Haram's leader rejects reports that he's been killed, saying, "Here will only die the day Allah takes my breath. Speaking in Arabic and Hausa, Shekau holds forth for about 15 minutes in a video lasting a little over half an hour. He says his group is running an Islamic caliphate and administering strict Sharia punishments, including amputations and stonings in the parts of northeastern Nigeria Boko Haram controls. Ofebia Kustafton, NPR News, Accra.
Millions of Muslims are heading to Mecca in Saudi Arabia for the beginning of the five-day Hajj pilgrimage. The spiritual journey this year will exclude Muslims from Ebola-stricken nations. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Republican Rand Paul, the junior senator from Kentucky, appears to be testing the waters for a presidential run. If he does run, Paul could be hobbled by past associations and statements, especially on race and foreign policy, writes my guest, Ryan Lizza, the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Lizza profiles Rand Paul on the current edition of The New Yorker in an article titled The Revenge of Rand Paul. If Rand Paul runs for president, it's also likely that the views of his father, former Congressman Ron Paul, will work against him with many voters. Ron Paul ran for president as the nominee of the Libertarian Party in 1988 and as an isolationist Republican in 2008 and 2012. Lizza writes about how Ron Paul influenced Rand Paul's politics and how Rand is now trying to rebrand himself to appeal to more mainstream voters. Rand also has to win over party leaders who considered his father an extremist. Ryan Lizza, welcome to Fresh Air. Is this profile of Rand Paul a sign that you think he's a serious contender for the Republican presidential nomination?
I do, although I have to say, over the course of reporting this over the summer, he may have gone from being a more serious contender to a less serious contender, or at least that's what some of the voices in the piece said. Just to give you one example, the piece opens with a quote from one of the most important Republicans in the country, the chairman of the Texas Republican Party. You know, that's the biggest Republican state party around. He's known the Paul family for decades. And he starts the piece by saying this summer that Rand Paul is one of the three most likely Republicans to win the nomination. And we can get to the reasons why, but by the end of the piece, this same person, his name is Steve Munastiri, when I called him last week to make sure that he was still on board with that quote, he said, well, I no longer believe that anymore because of the debate over foreign policy and sort of how it had boxed Rand Paul in. So, you know, we're so far out from 2016 and there are a lot of issues coming at these candidates. And the one issue where Rand Paul, I think, thought he had a great advantage, foreign policy, I think he thought the Republican Party was moving and still thinks that the Republican Party is moving more towards him on that issue. And then, you know, there's some question marks about that now that we can get into.
So, well, that's since you brought up foreign policy and foreign intervention, let's go there for a second. You know, with the war against ISIS now, he's shifted his views on that. So what did Rand Paul initially say about dealing with ISIS and what is he saying now?
Yeah, and it's complicated. And I think it's confused. His position on what to do about ISIS, I think, has been confusing. And maybe he hasn't shifted as much as we all thought, but it sounds like he's shifted. So let me try and take you through it. When I was interviewing him over the summer, he was going on at length about why the United States should never be involved in the Syrian civil war and stating all of the contradictions of the war. We're against Assad, but we're also against ISIS, which is Assad's enemy. Talking about the failures of the Iraqi army and how could you send American GIs back to Iraq to defend territory that the Iraqis can't defend, you know, making a fairly good case against intervening in, you know, a pretty chaotic place. Not all that different, frankly, than what Barack Obama has been saying for the last few years. Now, that was in July. What happened in the subsequent weeks, of course, was that ISIS became, the brutality of ISIS became an international story. The beheadings dominated the news. And there was a real movement among conservatives to do something about it. And this platform that Rand Paul has sort of succeeded on for quite a while now, which is we shouldn't be meddling in the Middle East. It's creating blowback. It's bad policy. That was really taking root in the Republican Party. And when I was interviewing him, he was citing polls about Republicans who are anti-intervention in Syria. ISIS really changed all that among conservatives especially. And Rand Paul responded to that change by coming out with a statement saying that he now believed that the United States should destroy ISIS militarily. Now, if you think what follows from a statement like that, that's a pretty serious statement. That means all-out war against ISIS. And that's the point where me and others thought, wow, this is a huge shift in policy. If you're really for destroying ISIS militarily, you are for a serious intervention in Iraq and Syria. Now, when it came down to it, there was not as much follow-through. There was no plan from Rand Paul to go over there and destroy ISIS militarily. And in fact, he voted against the legislation to arm the moderates, the so-called moderate opposition to Assad, who are also fighting ISIS. So that statement and that sort of series of being against intervention in Iraq and Syria, but then suddenly saying we need to destroy ISIS, but then suddenly leading the opposition against the legislation to arm the moderates, that confused a lot of people. But in some ways, he really did end up back where he started, which was against intervention.
It's been interesting to follow John McCain's reaction to Rand Paul. And McCain told you while you were reporting for this piece that if Rand Paul is the Republican nominee for president in 2016, McCain would support him. And he said to you, quote, "I've seen him grow and I've seen him mature and I've seen him become more centrist. I know that if he were president or a nominee, I could influence him, particularly some of his views and positions on national security. He trusts me, particularly on the military side of things, so I could easily work with him. It wouldn't be a problem."
Yeah.
Then
this blew me away, Terry.
Because, well, it's so odd because Rand Paul is so isolationist in his views, at least historically he's been. And McCain is usually one of the first people to say, go in there militarily.
Yeah, and they have been
in several countries, in several several scenarios, he's been leading the charge on that.
And as Rand Paul, alluding to McCain but not using his name early in the piece, told me, you know, he said these people have been wrong, that if we had listened to people like McCain, we'd be in 15 wars right now. So they have been absolutely at odds over foreign policy since Rand Paul's 2010 election. They have one of John McCain's closest advisors not that long ago, he wrote that if it were Rand Paul against Hillary Clinton in 2016, then responsible Republicans would have to vote for Hillary Clinton. And this is coming from Mark Salter, who is John McCain's best friend. So a lot of people thought maybe he was channeling the senator. Earlier this year, McCain was asked by another reporter if Rand Paul were the nominee, would he support him? And John McCain would not answer the question. So when I asked him the same question and McCain said what you just quoted, I was sort of shocked because he came out full. He fully said, if he's the nominee, he's my guy. Now, just to just to get at how complicated this relationship is, after I asked McCain that, and after he gave me this half-hour-long interview saying very favorable things about Rand Paul and talking about how Rand Paul had started wooing the conservative foreign policy establishment in the Republican Party, and he had started seeing things John McCain's way on a couple of issues, including aid to Israel. Well, lo and behold, they're in the middle of the ISIS debate, and Rand Paul tells a reporter that he alludes to a widely discredited conspiracy on the internet that said that John McCain had actually gone over to the Middle East and met with ISIS and had his picture taken. This did not sit very well with Senator McCain, and he went on TV and did a bunch of interviews blasting Senator Paul. So, of course, as this piece is closing, I'm watching all this, and I've got all these favorable quotes from John McCain in the piece. I call Senator McCain up again. I said, "Senator, you know, we had this long talk. You and Rand Paul seem to be on the same page on a lot of these issues suddenly, and ISIS really seems to have changed that. And by the way, you know, his comments about you meeting with ISIS." And as I say in the piece, Senator McCain was in a much less generous mood during that interview and, you know, had some much more critical things to say and pointed out that though Rand Paul had said he wanted to destroy ISIS militarily, it was just empty rhetoric. And so It's like for Rand Paul, it's like two steps forward, one step back. You know, his whole project now is to try and convince the Republican establishment that he is not that his policy views are not the same as his father's. And, you know, but he's trying to do that at the same time he doesn't want to lose his father's very hardcore base of support. And that's, it's very tricky. He's got a lot of balls in the air that he's trying to juggle.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ryan Lizza, who's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. And he has a new profile of Rand Paul called The Revenge of Rand Paul. One of the themes of your article is that Rand Paul is trying to mainstream his father's libertarian views and moderate some of his own views. Last weekend, Rand Paul spoke at the Values Voters Summit. The president of the Values Voters Summit is Tony Perkins, who is the head of the Family Research Council. And the Family Research Council's mission is to advance public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. And Rand Paul made his entrance on stage as a fetal ultrasound played for the audience. He said that liberty, virtue, and God were intertwined. He said, "I will take a stand for life." He quoted from Corinthians, where there is the Spirit of the Lord, there is liberty. And he endorses a personhood amendment that would grant a fertilized egg full rights of an individual and would make abortions, IUDs, and the morning after pill illegal. And I'm wondering if those views are traditionally considered compatible with libertarian views.
It does turn out, though, that among libertarians there is there's the same debate over abortion that is in the rest of the political conversation. There are what might be described as left libertarians who believe in abortion rights and obviously from a sort of anti-government position, but there are also right libertarians who will make the argument that with the protection of the state should start with the fertilized egg, and they're against abortion. Ron Paul was always pro-life. He's an obstetrician and gynecologist, and when he was practicing in Texas, he refused to do abortions. And so Rand Paul grew up with his really studying at his father's knee and adopted the same position. But there are a lot of social conservatives that have been very skeptical of both Ron and Rand Paul because they have a much more states' rights mentality, and they believe that these issues should be, including abortion, should be directed at the state level or regulated at the state level. And the other thing is the libertarians are viewed skeptically among a lot of social conservatives because a lot of social conservatives equate liberty with license. And on some of these social issues, Rand Paul doesn't see eye to eye with the social conservatives. I think the point that you mentioned, Terry, that he endorsed this personhood amendment was one way that Rand Paul was trying to tell social conservatives, hey, you may think I'm this hardcore libertarian who believes people should be free to do whatever they want, and I have very lax views about drug laws, but on this issue of abortion, I'm with you. I think it's created a whole nother problem for him because this personhood amendment is just not something that is, in a general election, it's going to be a very difficult issue. I mean, we're talking about birth control. We're talking about IUDs in the morning after pill, very common birth control methods that would be banned if the personhood amendment was the law of the land, right? This would make a fertilized egg the equivalent of a human being. And I don't think Rand Paul has really thought through how big a deal that would be. In fact, his former medical partner, a guy named John Downing, who's in Kentucky and has known Rand Paul for decades, he went on the record with me telling me that he has for a long time now tried to talk Rand Paul out of taking this personhood amendment. And he went on at length saying that this is just going to kill him if he's the nominee, especially among female voters. And so it's another area where Rand is trying to do so many things. He's trying to persuade social conservatives that he's with them. And so he moves into this personhood amendment, and then it creates all kinds of problems with other voters. And so on each of these issues, social conservatives, the foreign policy community, you know, by the end of reporting on this, I just started to think maybe his project is a little bit too difficult. He's got too many constituencies that he's trying to appease.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ryan Lizza. He's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. We're talking about his new profile of Rand Paul, which is called The Revenge of Rand Paul. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about Rand Paul with my guest Ryan Lizza, who is the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker and has profiled Rand Paul in a new New Yorker article titled The Revenge of Rand Paul. It seems like one of the groups he's trying to appeal to is the Christian right, which has a lot of overlap with the values voters.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what his own religious upbringing is and how that comes into play in his political worldview, if a lot of his political worldview is based on, you know, Christian values that have been, you know, fundamental to him.
Mm-hmm.
Or is this a kind of political maneuver to appeal to a certain group?
It's a really good question, because I do think people have a view of libertarians as libertarianism not being as compatible with the views of social conservatives. He actually grew up in a pretty traditional family. Every Wednesday, there was church activities. They grew up in a town called Lake Jackson in South Texas, not far from Houston, and not far from the Gulf Coast. And Lake Jackson, you know, was really a town of churches. So he grew up in the church. He was in the Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scouts met at the church. He went off to Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And it was at Baylor where he became a bit of a campus rebel, and we can talk about it, but joined one organization whose sort of, you know, role at the school was to kind of poke fun of the school's religiosity. And he would get into debates with fundamentalist Christians there. He was a biology student, and Baylor, although it's a Baptist school, it was not sort of, at that point, the National Baptist Convention was not as fundamentalist as it is now. And Baylor taught evolution. They taught a very, you know, solid scientific curriculum. But when Rand Paul was there, there was a sort of growing fundamentalist movement, and there was criticism of Baylor for teaching evolution, believe it or not. But he was on the non-fundamentalist side of those debates. His best friend in college told me that one of the things they used to do was every Sunday, he and his best friend would go to a different church. And they did this both just sort of open their mind about what other people's spirituality was like, but they also did it because they felt like a lot of the students at the school were too narrow-minded. And he and Rand Paul's best friend told me that they would engage fundamentalist Christians in debates. And one of the debates he said he remembers Rand having was over students who thought that doctors who performed abortions should receive the death penalty.
You know, you've said that when it comes to economics, that Rand Paul is as far to the right as you can get. What are some of his positions on that? I know one of them is not giving financial foreign aid to other countries, with the exception perhaps of Israel.
Well, this is one where he's shifted, right? This is both an economic and a foreign policy position. In his 2011 budget, if you look at that, when he first got to the Senate, he put together this budget that would balance in 5 years, and it would cut the Department of Commerce. We would get rid of several departments, including Commerce and Education and HUD. And on foreign policy, it would have ended all foreign aid, including the $3 billion a year we give to Israel. More recently, he said, okay, well, I was wrong about that. I would actually keep about $5 billion in foreign aid, including most of what we give to Israel. So that's a pretty significant shift.
And do you think his support for Israel is politically motivated?
Yes. I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe, you know, John McCain, the way he put it to me was, He took a trip to Israel a year ago or so ago.
Rand Paul took a trip to Israel.
Yeah, that Rand Paul, John McCain said, who pointed out this same shift in view, said, you know, Rand went to Israel and he came back a little bit different. Maybe it's genuine. Maybe he's rethought it and decided he was wrong. I will say, he was asked about this recently when he took a trip to Iowa, and he basically just said that he never supported cutting aid to Israel, and he wouldn't explain. Not only would he not explain his change of position, but he denied that he did change a position, which I think is a whole different problem for him. It's when he's moved on an issue, he has a real hard time admitting it.
Supporting financial support for Israel is a politically productive position for him to have because the Christian right supports that. And, of
Absolutely.
Course, Jewish voters, you know, many, probably most Jewish voters support that. So,
yeah. So it's exactly. Yeah. So, you know, politically in a Republican primary, there's a lot of pressure to be pro-Israel and, you know, not to cut the $3 billion a year we give them. I pushed him on this because I was interviewing him during the most dramatic phase of the Israeli offensive in Gaza, when some of the most pro-Israel voices in the American press were criticizing Israel and saying they were going too far. And I asked Rand, I said, do you agree with some of those voices? Do you agree that Israel, their operation in Gaza has gone too far, that the tactics are wrong? And he would not criticize Israel, and he would not, he told me it's not his job to. And I asked him, don't we have any responsibility to point out when we disagree with Israeli policy, considering how much foreign aid we're giving them, you know, because that is his view with Egypt. If we're giving money to Egypt, we should be able to massage or shape Egyptian policy. And he wouldn't answer. He just said, I think I've answered the question.
Ryan Lizza will be back in the second half of the show. His profile of Rand Paul is in the current issue of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, where consumers can browse, buy, and schedule local services online. More at angieslist.com. From The Honest Company, providing natural, eco-friendly products for the family and home. Learn more at honest.com. And from Here Music, with the 10th anniversary deluxe edition of Ray Charles's Genius Loves Company, including two bonus tracks and DVD. Now at Starbucks. This is NPR.
Coming up, how Rand Paul is trying to distance himself from his and his father Ron Paul's past statements about African Americans and civil rights. We'll also talk about Rand Paul's work on his father's campaigns as we continue our interview with Ryan Lizza, who profiles Rand Paul in the current New Yorker. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Hi Ho, the new album by Blake Mills.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ryan Lizza, the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. In the current issue, he profiles Rand Paul, Republican senator from Kentucky, who appears to be positioning himself to run for president. Lizza writes about how Paul is trying to rebrand himself as more mainstream, distancing himself from his own and his father's past associations and statements. His father, Ron Paul, is a former congressman who ran for president as the nominee of the Libertarian Party in 1988 and as a Republican in the presidential primaries of 2008 and 2012. Lizza's article is titled The Revenge of Rand Paul. Let's look at another issue in which he's trying to maybe distance himself from his own past and from his father's past, mm-hmm. and that's the issue of civil rights and other issues of particular interest to African Americans. So tell us some of the things you think he might be trying to distance himself from in his own past.
Well, look, he grew up in this world of pretty hardcore libertarianism. And as you probably remember, there was a time in this country where the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was controversial, and conservatives didn't believe the government had a role in addressing discrimination, and especially in addressing discrimination in the private sector. Barry Goldwater was against the 64 Civil Rights Act. Ronald Reagan was against the 64 Civil Rights Act. I think it's safe to say that there are really not any mainstream modern Republicans who voice opposition to that anymore. But Ron Paul, Rand Paul's father, was always against it, wrote about it, was quite consistently against it. And Rand Paul adopted the same view. And the view was that whatever you think about the evils of discrimination, that the government, the federal government, does not, should not have a role in policing discrimination, in especially in the private sector, right? That's the libertarian, that's the sort of long time libertarian view that both Ron Paul and Rand Paul consistently endorsed. And, you know, if you go back through, I went back through Rand's writings, and you see him endorse this view both in college at Baylor in the 80s, and then more recently in 2002 in an op-ed he wrote for his local newspaper in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and then probably most famously in 2010 when he was interviewed by Kentucky newspaper's editorial board, and he expressed the view that the core of the Civil Rights Act of 64, he opposed it. This became a major issue for him after he won his primary. It's continued to dog him. So this year, he really has tried
to back up a second. He's basically, what he was basically saying is that businesses have a right to not serve certain people, and that if they want to discriminate, no matter how terrible discrimination is, they have the right to do that. The government shouldn't tell them who they have to serve in a restaurant or who they have to sell to.
Exactly right. And, you know, his argument would be that those businesses will eventually fail in the marketplace because nobody would want to go to a business that endorses segregation. Now, as a lot of people will point out, you know, the sort of core of the issue of segregation was that African Americans couldn't go sit at the lunch counter, and so the idea that the market was sort of working in that area, I think has been discredited by history. But you know, Rand, long past a lot of other people on the right, held on to this position and articulated it in 2010, and it caused a firestorm because it's not possible in modern American politics to be against the cornerstone legislation that ended segregation. So to his credit, I think one of the things he's done over the last year is he has really tried to have a dialogue with African Americans. And I think he's tried to think through, you know what, I'm a libertarian. There's a lot of criminal justice issues that are important to the African-American community. Maybe I can repair my relationship with the African-American community by finding some of the issues that we both believe in. I mean Rand Paul. And he's done something very interesting. You know, he's actually, more than any Republican candidate out there, he has put together a series of reforms that really speak to a lot of the key issues that African-American leaders are talking about when it comes to the problems in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, tell us about the criminal justice package that he sponsored in the Senate.
Yeah, so he would restore voting rights for nonviolent felons. This is a huge issue because, you know, people with in most states with people with felonies can't vote, and it create, you know, that's a big problem. No Republican has yet endorsed that position, although many Democrats have. He would get rid of the sentencing disparity for crack and powdered cocaine, you know, which has a huge racial component, of course. And he would get rid of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws. And he has actually talked about letting people out of prison who have been sentenced under some of these laws. And what I think is interesting about it is, you know, every election cycle we read about Republican outreach to the African-American community, and the Republicans' share of the black vote has been, you know, going down and down every cycle. Nothing has worked for the Republican Party. And Rand actually did his homework. He went and talked to African-American leaders and sort of tried to understand, you know, what the proper way of approaching that community was, because and was very honest about the fact that he didn't have a lot of familiarity in that community. And what he learned, one of the people that influenced him was a very important African-American leader in Louisville named Reverend Kevin Cosby. And what Cosby told him was, look, the problem with both Democrats and Republicans nowadays is they want to view America as this post-racial society, and so they don't want to actually talk about issues that are important specific to black voters. They just want to talk about issues that are important to Americans in general. And, you know, both Republicans and Democrats will say, well, if you follow our agenda, it will help white Americans, non-white Americans, everyone. And Cosby said, that's not the way it should be. And he said, you need to go to the African-American community and address issues that they specifically care about and acknowledge that racism exists in America and that it needs to be dealt with. And so he's really taken that approach to heart. And for instance, after the images on television in the wake of the Ferguson protests with the over-militarized police, Rand Paul wrote an op-ed saying this is a racial issue, right? That black and brown people are more more affected by this than white people. And that, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if African Americans are going to suddenly be, you know, for Rand Paul. There's a lot of issues there. But it's interesting to watch him sort of try and figure out what the right way to address that community is, and do it in a way that no other Republican is doing.
After Ferguson, didn't he talk about demilitarizing the police?
He did. And this is where, you know, this is not the other thing I should point out, of course, what he did more recently is he's very forthrightly said he supports the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So he is finished with his sort of, you know, dorm room libertarian view.
But did he explain why he changed his mind on that?
No, he didn't. And I think that's a real weakness that he has, is he just, not only did he not explain it, he basically refuses to admit it. He's a little bit thin-skinned, I will say, from spending some time with him, and he really does not. He has a hard time acknowledging that he was wrong, and he has a hard time acknowledging that he's changed his position.
Could you tell us what else is in his criminal justice package?
So one of the big issues that he's trying to address is that besides, you know, the fact that nonviolent felons are losing voting rights, if you have a felony on your record forever, it makes employment really, really difficult. And this is a big problem in the African-American community. And he does have a plan to expunge nonviolent felonies after a certain period of time. And his argument about that is all about employment and the difficulty, you know, voting is one thing, but landing a job, if you have a felony on your record and can't ever have it expunged, you know, there's always that question on the employment application, have you ever had a felony, or do you have a felony on your record? And he would do something to address that. Now, on all of these issues, there are Democratic proposals that frankly go further, right? So it's not like Rand Paul has invented, you know, this whole agenda. But I think it's interesting and notable that he has not been able to get a single Republican co-sponsor for any of these ideas. Republicans just won't touch it yet because, you know, restoring rights or doing anything for former felons is just not popular in the Republican Party. So, you know, in that sense, there's no doubt, Terry, that this agenda is driven by political reasons and by the criticism he took over his views on the Civil Rights Act. I think we'd be naive if we didn't mention that. At the same time, you know, this is what makes him interesting politically, is that his libertarian views, you know, this is not something that is outside of his comfort zone in terms of his ideology, right? He, you know, he believes in less power for the state. He believes that the criminal justice system and the war on drugs has gone too far. So in that sense, this marriage of some of the ideas on the agenda of the African American community and Rand Paul's libertarianism, they sort of match up here.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ryan Lizza, the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. He profiles Rand Paul in the current edition. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ryan Lizza. He's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, and in the current edition, he profiles Rand Paul. Rand Paul worked for several of his father's campaigns, starting, I think, in 1984 when Rand took a semester.
Before that,
okay.
He started, the first campaign he ever worked for was 1974 when he was 11 years old and he knocked on doors for his father.
Oh, okay. I guess I wasn't counting that.
Yeah.
No, and then in 84, he takes a semester off from college to work for his father's campaign. And you say at one point, like, Rand Paul started to repackage his father's feud to try to make them sound more mainstream conservative. What did Rand Paul try to do to repackage his father's libertarian views that many people would describe as extreme and try to make them sound more mainstream?
Yeah, they had this relationship where the dad, you know, was the ideological id, but the son was a little bit more of the political strategist. Not that he disagreed with his father, but he tried to figure out ways to help him win elections. And so, you know, when they returned in 84, they just got completely wiped out. There wasn't even a close race, and that's when Ron Paul temporarily retired from politics. But in 96, when Rand was older, and helped his father return to the House of Representatives. You know, if you look through some of the ads that they ran, I went back into the archives and looked at some of the newspaper ads and how they presented Ron Paul. They would argue that Ron Paul had changed, that he had mellowed, that he would be more cooperative when he got to Congress, because in his first stint in Congress in the 70s and 80s, he was known for, you know, not really playing ball with his colleagues in the Republican Party, and they ran ads that just generally painted him as a more generic Republican, you know, a Republican who's going to lower your taxes and get the economy going again. It was much, you know, they sanded off some of the rough edges in that campaign, and that was the one where Rand really took a leadership role in.
But it was in that campaign that Ron's opponent, Charles Morris, got a hold of some of the newsletters, Ron Paul's newsletters, that had quotes in them like, "We are constantly told that it is evil to be afraid of black men, but it is hardly irrational. Black men commit murders, rapes, robberies, muggings, and burglaries, all out of proportion to their number." And you quote that in your article, and you also quote one of the Ron Paul newsletters as saying that most black males in Washington, D.C. were, quote, semi-criminal to entirely criminal, unquote, and, quote, only about 5% of blacks have sensible political opinions, unquote. And you say at the time Ron Paul didn't dispute that he wrote these articles, but years later he said that they were ghostwritten.
And that was news to me, because I remember when this controversy erupted much later in the 2012 campaign. But when you go back and look at the Texas newspapers that covered the 96 campaign, when I think people don't remember this, but the racist newsletters that Ron Paul wrote was a huge issue in his 96 campaign. And during that campaign, he did not deny that he wrote them. And the newspapers at the time reported just straight up that he did write them. And it went undisputed by Ron Paul. Now, many years later, he said, well, they weren't, you know, yes, I sold them, but I didn't write them. You know, frankly, to me, it's not really much of a distinction.
So what does that say about Rand, Ron Paul's son, who is working on his father's campaigns? One would assume he's read those newsletters and didn't do anything to back away from those racist statements, didn't do anything at the time to try to moderate those racist statements?
I think this is where you get into the question of how much does the son have to pay for the sins of the father?
But let me just interrupt here. The son worked for the father on that campaign and was, you know,
theoretically and
supporting.
Win it.
Yeah, and was theoretically supporting his father's views.
Absolutely. I think that will, if he runs, that will be an issue for him. And a legitimate issue is, what did you know about your father's newsletters? You worked on that campaign. You said you helped win it. You told, you know, he's boasted about Jim helping his dad win that campaign. It's a small family. The family is very close. Were you reading your dad's newsletters, right? Those are all questions. I didn't explore every avenue of that, but there's no doubt that this issue of race that has sort of haunted the Paul family now for many, many years is one that's going to play a huge role if he runs for president.
You've talked a little bit about how Rand Paul is courting different constituencies in the Republican Party and maybe trying to court some Democratic African Americans as well. What about his father's followers? What is he doing to get their vote?
Well, this is the sort of jam he's in. I think he believes that he doesn't need to do anything to get their vote, because a lot of his father's followers are not Republicans. They are people who wouldn't be involved in the Republican Party if not for Ron Paul, and they might not vote for some Republican candidates in a general election. And so, you know, he's in a little bit of a box because he can't lose the enthusiasm and, frankly, the fundraising base that his father built. This is a very small but intensely committed subgroup in American politics that was able to raise $35 million for Ron Paul. And they were able to fund Rand Paul's Senate campaign in Kentucky. And as he told me, he never would have won that Kentucky seat if it weren't for his dad's fundraising network. And so, you know, he's in a tricky place because every time he makes a move to satisfy the John McCain wing of the party, it will anger someone it will anger one of his more libertarian leading constituents.
Is there anything that you found particularly surprising or particularly enlightening when you were reporting this piece on Rand Paul?
One thing that stood out to me is this is really a piece about a father and son who share so much in common. And the reason that the son got to where he is in life is because of his father. He wouldn't be a United States senator without his father. And he told me as much. And now for him to take the next step to get where he wants to go next, his father is basically what's standing in the way, and his father's history and associations. And, you know, that's an awfully tough predicament to be in for a politician. I mean, one of the things I was really surprised to learn, you know who the best man at Rand Paul's wedding was?
Who?
It was his dad. It was Ron Paul. And so, you know, he obviously has a deep affection and relationship with his dad. And yet his dad's sort of peculiar mix of associations and outrageous statements that are going to haunt him when he runs for president.
Thank you so much. I always enjoy talking with you. I really appreciate you doing this.
Likewise. Always a pleasure.
Ryan Lizza's profile of Rand Paul is in the current issue of The New Yorker. Lizza is the magazine's Washington correspondent. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Blake Mills' new album, Hi Ho. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. Blake Mills has done a lot in his 28 years. As a guitarist, he's accompanied singers including Lucinda Williams, Neil Diamond, Kid Rock, and Lana Del Rey. He's produced songs for such acts as Fiona Apple and Alabama Shakes. His new album, his second, is called Hi Ho, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it's notable for the diversity of its sound.
Blake Mills spends a lot of time on Hi Ho sneaking up behind you, offering confidences in a low murmur. He's a young master of intimacy, quiet but firmly insistent, making sure that even if you don't quite make out what he's saying, you walk away with a melody lingering in your mind. He plays guitar in a way that can make the instrument yield warm folk song strumming or unearthly, strange sounds, sometimes within the same composition. He's a sneaky one, Blake Mills. On the fourth cut on this album, Mills says it's the seventh song on an album that always makes him cry.
It's the seventh song on the record that always makes me cry. It's been 7 years since we caught each other's eye. You're the seventh true love I've had in my life, and the only one I take to be my bride. Well, those who oppose our union, it's fine to say what they will. Just talk.
In the interests of reportorial accuracy based on Mills' premise, it's my duty to note that the seventh song on this album is called Silence is Sincerity, a noodling instrumental just over a minute long that won't make anyone cry. There's a cleverness about Mills' songs that, at their best, don't render them merely clever. The song Seven includes Fiona Apple, a frequent collaborator on vocals. Its rhythm section consists of producer and record label president Don Was on bass, and on drums, Jim Keltner, who, now in his 70s, has played behind scores of prominent musicians including John Lennon and Bob Dylan. It's easy to hear why veterans like playing with Blake Mills. His best songs sound at once novel and familiar.
I found a new meaning. The oldest words in use. Now I no longer ask myself, what have I got to lose if I'm unworthy of the power I hold over you?
I sometimes think it's unfair to make those this guy sounds like that guy sorts of comparisons, but with Hi Ho, it's almost inescapable, and for once, actually more intriguing. That's because on this album, Blake Mills seems to have consumed a very specific body of material, acts signed to Warner Brothers Records in the 70s. Blake Mills commences his collection with the song I just played called If I'm Unworthy. It features a melody that wouldn't be out of place on a Van Dyke Parks album, a vocal that could harmonize with Lowell George on a Little Feat record, a lyric that reminds me of early Randy Newman slyness, and guitar I would assert was influenced by Ry Cooder. What all that results in is music that's at once laid back and slow-building powerful, in which self-deprecating lyrics take a backseat to melodies that always contain sneaky hooks. It all comes together most strikingly, I think, on Don't Tell Our Friends About Me.
The older I am, the
wiser I'm known. I felt ashamed of how angry I'd gone. I know I was not getting my message across. I know you can't stand me when that's how I talk. When I summon a duel or whatever it is you thought. I was wrong, turning all this thing against you. Sure, some of them could use a good talk, but babe, don't tell all about me. Please, baby, don't tell our friends about me.
That's a beautiful song, and I didn't even get to the bridge, which features the loveliest use of a four-letter word I've heard in a long time. Hi Ho takes its title from Walt Disney's Seven Dwarfs. Hi Ho, Hi Ho, it's off to work we go. Roughly half of Blake Mills's album is carefully constructed work that achieves mysteriously beautiful music. The other half is a collection of intriguing sketches, snatches of melodies that don't quite resolve themselves. You're left feeling that you've spent time with a very interesting fellow, restless and inventive, someone you want to keep in touch with, as the kid continues his roundabout journey.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Hi Ho by Blake Mills. You can like Fresh Air on Facebook and get links to our interviews. It's also a great place to comment on our show and interact with other Fresh Air listeners. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Married Susanna in a place called Havana.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Penguin, publisher of Belzar by Meg Wolitzer, a novel about boarding school teens touched by tragedy and struggling for redemption. Available now. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security at Cigna.com. And from Fox Broadcasting, with the 10-part mystery event Grace Point, starring David Tennant and Anna Gunn, premieres tonight at 9, 8 Central on Fox. This is NPR.
The cult leader and killer Charles Manson borrowed from the teachings of pimps, Dale Carnegie, Jesus, Scientology, and the counterculture to make young women believe in him, follow him, and fear him. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeff Gwynn, author of the book Manson, which has just been published in paperback. Join us.